we take a single episode of a science fiction TV series and overanalyze it to within an inch of its life. This is the Fusion Patrol Podcast. Welcome to the discussion. Hello, I'm Eugene, and tonight I have guest host Simon with me. Good evening, Simon.
Good evening. It's a pleasure to be here, as always.
And you are listening to Fusion Patrol. Tonight we are on our next episode of The Prisoner, in part of our ongoing series. Tonight's episode is The Schizoid Man by Terence Feely. We'll start off with a not very brief summary, I'm afraid. But, you know, when they're not brief, that means the episode's got a lot going on, right? Seems fair.
Yeah, which could be a good thing one way or the other.
Number 6 is working with number 24, an attractive young woman with Zener cards. She appears to be genuinely psychic and scores better than 70% accuracy on the psychic test. She is eagerly preparing to enter the village talent contest next month and is practicing her psychic act, in which she clearly has a connection to number 6. And also, her photography. She has a long way to go with a master photography, though, and she accidentally hurts number 6's fingernail in her enthusiasm while taking pictures. That night, number 6 is drugged and taken. There is a brief indication that something is being done to him with electric shock and surgery. In the morning, the next day, he awakes in a strange room with dark hair and a mustache. His familiar black outfit now bears the badge of number 12. He is summoned to number 2's office for a working breakfast. Like on his day of arrival, he is presented with a food they already knew he wanted. But it is flapjacks, not number 6's food of choice. But it is what he wanted. Number 2 spells out their new master plan. He, the one being called number 12, bears a remarkable physical resemblance to their star prisoner, number 6. His job is to shake number 6's strongest asset, his unshakable sense of self. Number 12 will pretend to be number 6 until number 6 cracks. The one being called number 12 says, "Yes, that will take a lot of work to convince me I'm not number 6. "Oh, good job. You're already in the part," says number 2. The one called number 12 is given some cosmetic work to dye his hair and shave his mustache. He now looks exactly like he used to. He is now also renumbered to be number 6. They go to number 6's apartment, which is subtly changed, causing some consternation. Number 2 leaves, and another number 6 enters the apartment. He is an exact duplicate, save that he is wearing white. The posturing for identity begin, but white number 6 is more familiar with the apartment's current layout. Meanwhile, black number 6 is not faring well. He is now instinctually left-handed, unlike the real number 6 who is right-handed. He no longer likes the same types of cigars or cigarettes. After some verbal sparring, in which black number 6 does not come out well, they go to the recreation hall where they practice marksmanship with electronic guns. White number 6 insists that black number 6 shoot right-handed, and white number 6 wins easily. They fence, and again white number 6 gets the upper hand. Outside, black number 6 is getting agitated, and he and white 6 box. Black's number 6 is trounced. Rover collects them and takes them to see number 2. Number 2 tortures white number 6, trying to find out why he has infiltrated the village, and is trying to impersonate black number 6. White number 6 doesn't crack. "I am number 6, he shouts. Next, they demonstrate to white number 6 that his fingerprints don't match. At the same time, on the master control scene, which number 6 and black number 6 only can see, it is also obvious that white number 6's fingerprints are the genuine article. Black number 6 tries a gambit, knowing number 2 cannot fail to play along. He calls number 24 and has her bring her cards. The psychic link will prove who is the real number 6. Number 2 looks a bit nervous, but he needn't have. The game was rigged, and number 24 accurately divines only the cards white number 6 is looking at. She also reveals that the real number 6 has a mole on his arm. Both number 6s reveal their moles, but surprise! Black number 6 hasn't got one! No one is more surprised than black number 6. Number 24 and white 6 leave. Number 2 is furious that his team failed to put a fake mole on black number 6. Heads will roll. That night, black 6, in number 12's apartment, is having nightmares. He is cracking. When he awakes, he notices the injury on his finger. He looks at the photo from yesterday when it was new, and it has clearly healed for weeks. And he begins remembering. He remembers the electric shock training to make him left-handed. He remembers growing his beard and then having it dyed and trimmed. He remembers being trained to like flapjacks. He discovers in his apartment that his cigars have been tampered with to make them unsmokable to him. He gambles, and he shocks his left hand, reversing the brainwashing. He slips out to confront white number 6. First, he encounters some guards, and he learns that the password number 2 gave him, Gemini, doesn't work. They fight, and he defeats them. He gets into white number 6's quarters. White 6 has a nerve gas gun. Black Six pretends not to know who he is, that he's cracking up, and when White Six goes for the phone call to number two, Black Number Six jumps him. This time, Black Six handily wins. He forces the real password and name from White Six, now revealed to be Curtis. Curtis tries to escape, but Rover corners them both. Black Six uses the password first, and when Curtis tries to run, Rover kills him. Black Six now puts on White Six clothes. He contacts Number Two and gives him the password and identifies himself as Curtis. He says Number Six is dead. Later at a briefing, Black in White Six makes a minor mistake, but he seems to have pulled off his deception. He is sent to see Number 24 to see if they have any real insight into Number Six. During the meeting, it seems that Number 24 realizes that Black and White Six is the real Six. Number Two takes Black and White Six to the heliport. They talk business and family, which Black and White Six tries to bluff through, but Number Two is getting suspicious. Number 24 meets them and tells Black and White Six that she didn't want to betray Number Six and she wouldn't do it again. Despite the suspicions, Number Two puts Black and White Six on the helicopter, blinds him because of standard security, and sends him on his way. He is free, and when the helicopter lands, they are back in the village. Black and White Six had not known that Curtis's wife was dead for over a year and had made a fatal slip-up in conversation. He is, once again, just Number Six. Okay.
Zebra Crossing Six.
Yes. I tried to make that a shorter summary, but it's like, you really, you can't. It's just there's too much you got to cover. I don't know. I like the episode. What? How about you?
I was definitely entertained by this episode. I liked it. I have this thing about doubles episodes. They can be really good, or they can be pretty terrible, and it kind of depends on how the show handles them, because they obviously rely a certain amount on a pretty improbable coincidence. Have you ever met your exact double?
No, but I'm frequently told I look like Bill Gates, which I don't look anything like him.
So you know your exact double's out there. Okay, yeah, I can see that.
I wish I could just give his money.
I've never met, you know, all you've got to do is creep up behind him, club him, take his place, and go and pretend to be him.
I'd have to give up using an iPhone, though. I don't think I could do that. Not and go to a Windows phone. It's not happening.
Yeah.
No, that would be a tough one. That'd be a tough one.
Too great a price to pay. But, I mean, I've never met my exact precise double. I don't know, Doctor Who episodes, they seem to do loads of these, and they're pretty always ludicrous. The Avengers, on the other hand, have done a few of these, and they've tended to be extremely good. And I kind of felt this one was somewhere in between. I found it an entertaining episode, and I did kind of find myself sitting there guessing and kind of wondering where each twist was going. But it's one of those where you think this is wow at the beginning. Wow, he's been taken off. He's got a moustache. He's been told he's someone else. What a brilliant setup! It's really intriguing and it's fantastic. But then I didn't necessarily expect that would lead straight into having a double. And obviously, any show where they do this, they're basically doubling up on actors so they can use the same actor for two parts. There are a huge number of appeals, I think, for the production from this. One is they're paying one person to do two characters and they don't have to do any extra kind of acting. Well, except they have to do twice as much. But
yeah, but then their line count goes up. So, I mean, that's the first thing actors do when they get a script. How many lines have I got? Well, you get
which they like, of course. And it's fun, particularly if you've got a script where, you know, you have to fight with yourself. You have to fence with yourself, which is, of course, very convenient for the people doing special effects because you can just slap a mask on their faces.
And use your standard stunt double.
Yeah, exactly. So... But you know, it's probably quite a fun thing to do, you know, and I think that's going to appeal to those who are making the show. It doesn't necessarily make it great fun to watch, but in this case, I think McGoohan did a good job of giving suitably differentiated performances as both number sixes, as it were. But because you're guessing so hard, I mean, I don't know. The first thing was I sat all the way through it, thinking that we had the wrong number six, that you get whatever five episodes in we've watched. I guess it may not be the same if you're not watching them in the same order, but certainly pretty much from the start, you get the idea that the prisoner, the show, is going to try and put one over on you. And it's pretty much like number six doesn't trust anyone in the village. I don't trust any episode of The Prisoners Play It Straight with me. If someone says there's something, I just am flat out not going to believe it, even if the proof is right there. So for the first thing is, if we are supposed to believe that the, as you put it, the black number six, the number 12 we see who shaves the moustache, is the real number six, I'm thinking, well, hang on, are we sure about that?
I don't know that I doubted that one, but
There was nothing in it, and I'm sure it was deliberate. There was nothing in it to kind of say this. It could not be a twist the other way round. Obviously, there's something going on here, and we don't go into it in too much detail. But there's something going on here that allows them to take away someone's short-term memories. And given the kind of sci-fi we've seen in this, with, for example, the dream reading, it doesn't seem too much of a stretch to suppose that they could implant some memories. Not that you'd be certain they were your memories, but that it would be enough to create a kind of doubt in there. So it's perfectly possible that number six we see being taken away, and then actually the person we're really seeing having his moustache shaved off is number 12, and our number six, just happens to have changed his jacket and comes back to his flat. The jacket is one thing, but is it so much more implausible to suppose that he just happens to have got a new jacket than that his mole has been shaved off, that he's lost the ability to smoke his favourite cigars, or that his dexterity, I don't quite know how you put this, but his dexterity has switched.
Mm-hmm.
So he's no longer right-handed, which is a much bigger change than a new jacket, right?
Yes, I would hope so. I certainly can't switch.
That seemed to me the twist that they were building up to, and I think it was probably deliberate. And of course, when they don't deliver on that, there's a little bit of sense of anticlimax on that. I think it's very well handled, so I wasn't disappointed by it, but all the same, I did wonder about it.
I would say that of all the stories I can think of over the years that I've seen that have had a double in it, this has got to be my favorite. It really does.
Really? Have you seen the Avengers 3's Company? New Avengers Faces?
I'm sure that I have. Now, it's been a long time on the New Avengers one. But I like it because the central... I mean, yeah, you know, the fact that you get people with the same face is ridiculous. Whether or not we were ever supposed to doubt that that was really number six, I don't think it was in the intention of the writer because... And this is, you know, one of those things where I've read the earlier drafts of the script. And the montage we see later where he's remembering the things that happened to him were actually shot to occur after he went to sleep that first night. So
you've got to ask, what's the intention of changing that then? So that
behind two scenes. You know, they left behind the where the guy's coming at him in a pole in the bed going left hand, and also a scene where they're doing something with his wrist in a surgical. They're not showing the surgery, but they're in kind of like a doc, it says patient and then a doctor's office, and they're doing something to his wrist. And why did they leave those behind? I'm not sure. But to me, those...
Well, I think you've got to have something, otherwise it's too big a cheat when you do get the reveal. And unless there's something in there to kind of signpost it, enough that you've thought, I'm not sure what they're doing, but, you know, the question is raised in your mind. If you've never seen any of it, and then suddenly, oh, big reveal, you know, they did all this stuff. That just seems a bit, you know, like hand-wavy to me. So I can see why they left it in, but I'm questioning the intention of moving it.
Well,
because I think that...
Let's pretend for a second that they could find this doppelganger. I mean, and... I agree that the conceit of finding a doppelganger in the world is pretty unlikely. I don't believe that for every person there's a duplicate out there, but there are people who look very close. I have seen a couple people who look very close to one another. And so I would think that maybe they could find somebody in the entire world that looked like number six a bit, or at least close enough to make the job work. I cannot believe that they would find somebody who was also an agent of the same caliber. And I think we have to assume that he was of nearly the same caliber as number six, because he did a remarkably good job of being number six. Now, we don't know exactly because how close they were, because real number six is playing a little subpar game because of the games they've played on him. But still, he was doing a very good job. I mean, he had the mannerisms, he had the personality. It's as if Patrick McGoohan was actually playing the part as himself. So that was, you know, that we have to assume that he's good.
But again, the purpose of that, as with the purpose of the editing, is to make you think, you, the audience, think, yes, he could be number six.
Would the plan as outlined by number two, in other words, we've got a doppelganger, we're going to put him in your number six's place, and we're going to shake his self of confidence, would that have worked? In other words, if they'd actually done that plan, if if doppelganger six had come in and been put in the room, and real number six had come in and found him there just as they did in reverse, and then the two of them spent the next month in the village trying to compete with one another, would that have ever had any effect on the real number six?
I don't know, but actually my assumption was that they'd said exactly the same thing to both of them, because there's scenes where you see that the fake or white number six is actually number 12, the same thing that he said to the real number six. And there's a password for fake number six to use, in much the same way as there was a password given to the real number six.
Mm-hmm.
So the setup is clearly, it's totally interchangeable. You could switch it right round. But I think in a way you're putting your finger on something there, saying, would that work? Because I don't think, if you didn't have that, if you didn't have number six pretending to be or playing a role, being forced into a role where he is the one trying to do something to number six, that wouldn't have the same effect and it would be far less interesting. I think the problem with this story is it's not actually a doppelganger story. It would have worked, it might have worked better if it hadn't had an exact copy of number six, because I don't see any reason why you would need a copy of number six to carry out the plan that they carried out. Having him look identical serves no actual purpose in this.
Good point, except, of course, in the case of Allison.
Well,
and
no,
the psychic trick. I mean, that's held out to us.
But she's fixed. She's fixed. That we get that reveal at the end. She was in with number two.
Correct.
So it wouldn't have made any difference to her if... Oh, I see.
Dramatically, it would have made a difference, because she would just walked in and go, well, that's number six, that's number 12, and they wouldn't have needed to do the psychic thing.
Yeah, but they could have looked... They could have looked similar, but yes, okay, yes. I take your point there, but I do think there's something to be gained from that. At first, I thought there might not even be a kind of real number six inhabiting the space. I thought they might be putting... So our real number six, black number six, as you put him, gets set up with this assignment, and he's being prepped by number two to go in and replace number six to take his place. But I wondered if actually the conceit around this was going to be that number six was supposedly just watching him take his place. So he was going to rely on a mind game with number six by making him play himself, even though he was himself. And he would just do that on a stage where he couldn't see the audience. He would be informed that number six was somewhere. And of course, all sorts of little things would suggest that he wasn't doing a good enough job at being number six. And that would undermine his own self of identity.
Hmm.
And I thought that was where they were going for it. And I think partly that was what the story was playing with.
I was going to say, were you surprised when a actual white number six walked in the door?
I mean, yes. Up until the point where it became clear that another number six would appear, and then I kind of thought, oh, right, okay, yeah, it's a doppelganger story. They've got double McGowans in. And so it made sense. It kind of clicked for me then. But I did think that there could be a more interesting story being told if you had another party, and it wouldn't have to be an identical other party, but it would have to be someone else who thought that they were, or who was professing to think that they were number six, and had all of number six's skills and mannerisms, and in effect was more number six than number six was because of the various things about his own identity that had been undermined. And those things would lead our number six in the position of being an undercover number six, being in fact a number 12, trying to put pressure on the real number six, that those would lead him to behave in a way that... you're familiar with the Milgram experiment, are you?
It doesn't sound familiar.
Stanley Milgram, and this would be the early 60s, so it's been a few years before this would have been written, was a psychologist who conducted an experiment in which he got a number of testers to administer electric shocks to subjects.
Yes, okay.
The experiment is now very famous, and the testers had to increase the voltage that was being given to the subjects, and they raised it incrementally to a point where they knew it would be at a lethal level. And actually what Milgram was doing, and it's interesting from an ethical point of view, but actually what Milgram was doing was experimenting on the people who thought they were the testers. The subjects were actors, because they weren't really being given lethal electric shocks, and he wanted to know how many of the testers would refuse to go ahead with it and how many would simply follow orders. And famously, a number of them did administer these shocks to a lethal level. Now, I thought that
the good old days when we didn't have ethics involved.
Well, exactly. And of course, this is something that in the village, number two is going to be unencumbered by.
Right.
So I thought that he was trying to perhaps put number six, who he was calling number 12, in a position where he would become intent on forcing number six, the fake number six, to admit that he wasn't really number six, that he would resort to unethical methods that were not the kind of methods that the real number six would stoop to. Because as we know, one of the hallmarks of his character is he's a very moral person. And so the aim would be to undermine his identity and put him in an extreme position where he acted against his own nature, and in so doing undermine his personality. And I wondered if it was going to go down that route. And to me, they didn't really go there at all. They kind of went more for the doppelganger thing, which I thought was a bit less interesting.
Mm. Now, one thing that kind of I can't quite figure out where they're going with, because there's two totally opposing, potentially successful goals here for them. The first is they're trying to get real number six self-identity to be shaken so that he begins to have doubts and think that maybe he is number 12, which seems to be the straightforward goal. At the same time, have we not already really established that even though he goes by number six, number six does not acknowledge that he is number six? And just the fact that he'll always take his name badge off and not go by that. So you also have him trying to positively enforce in his mind, yes, I am number six. I am a number. It's two sides of the same coin there. Do they win either way? He's cemented his identity now a little bit more as I am number six at the end of this episode.
That's a nice way of looking at it, I think, because for me that did strike something of a false note. Because I thought he wouldn't stick to his identity as being number six. He might slip into that, but you would have thought that he would, certainly the real number six at least, would be a little bit more conscious of the fact that he had a real name, and that he would say that name as being his identity.
Mm-hmm.
Although you imagine for reasons of preserving the mystique on the show, it wouldn't be, when he said the name, it wouldn't be something that we would be allowed to hear. But it's in much the way that he would be conscious of that distinction between his number and his name, unlike other people perhaps in the village who are more compliant than him. And when he actually does force number 12, number 12 gives up his name, and he is Curtis, so he gets the identity there. So it seemed to me odd that the kind of reveal, the true moment of identification for the false number 6 was not admitting that he is number 12, but admitting that his name is Curtis, but number 6 only ever focused on the fact that he was a number, not a name.
Yeah. It's a little bit of a conundrum. One of the things I wanted to bring up is that Terence Feely, who wrote this episode, had been brought in by, I guess, Markenstein, the producer, because of some quote-unquote weirdish scripts, psychological scripts that he liked and they felt that they were in tune with. And Patrick McGoohan, whether he liked the guy or whether he liked the script so much, then brought him in as one of the producers. He liked this script so much. Also, just for Fusion Patrol purposes, Terence Feely also wrote at least two episodes of UFO for Gary Anderson, which we haven't gotten to yet. It's a couple of later episodes. I think The Man Who Came Back and Time Lash, I think, are the two episodes he wrote. And they're kind of weird ones compared to regular UFO episodes, which are pretty straightforward and normal.
Apart from the hair.
Hey, you know, the hair, the mustache. Oh, wait, no, that's this one. Yeah. Let's see, what else is there in this episode? So what about the ESP thing? This is the thing that really dates this episode to me, because you can look at shows from the 60s, and I think you can perhaps credibly write a story and say, you know, maybe there is such a thing as ESP. I'm not saying that there was in the 1960s, but that in the 1960s and the early 1970s, there was so much of that bad science going on that was being published and saying, yes, you know, we're finding that this is actually a real phenomena, that you could be forgiven for writing it into a script. Whereas hopefully now, if you wrote that into a script, you'd just get laughed out of the script meeting.
Well, I don't know. I think it's probably enough bad science floating around, and it partly depends on the context. But clearly, in this case, there's supposed to be a certain amount of realism to these psychological things. The problem for me, or perhaps the bonus for me, because I wasn't too bothered by it, is that I don't know enough kind of magic circle tricks to know about the way in which you would do, and because she calls it an act. She calls it her mind-reading act. You're helping me with your mind-reading act.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know enough about how she would read him in order to know what's on the card if she were actually performing this as an illusionist, and how to what extent that is possible with it, without his collusion or whatever, just by virtue of being able to very carefully read those kind of tells and things, or even whether this might have involved some level of collusion, because the point is a relationship between the two of them that no one else would have known about. So whether he is giving those signs consciously or unconsciously, she needs to pick them up when it matters in the crucial situation in number two's office, shall we call it. And clearly the problem is, at that point, she doesn't pick them up. And there could be another set of tells or signals or whatever that fake number two is giving her that she does pick up in order for, in that case, for her to get a higher strike rate. So you could read it in that way if you were as ignorant as I am about the tricks of that kind of illusion, I think. Or you could read it as straight, you know, yes, it is ESP.
So I think, and I'll take this from strictly what we see on the screen, I think it's supposed to be real, because in the end, we have that scene where Black Six in white clothes goes to see her at the end, and he has turned his back to her completely and is, you know, I don't know why he's turned his back to her. That's kind of uncharacteristic, but it's intentional. And after he's turned her back, she reaches to go for a cigarette. And at the exact same moment, he reaches and pulls out his lighter and lights it and then turns around. And when he does that, he kind of gives that, oops, I made another screw up. I have to stop playing with lighters, as if he's one of those people that's always pulling out a lighter and just flicking it for no reason. And I think he's doing that to cover the fact that was clearly a little psychic link between the two of them. And I think that's the point where she realizes that he's the real number six as they go on. So, you know, she may have simply been reading both of their minds, number six and white, black and white number six. And she just intentionally gave wrong answers when she was reading black six's cards. And she was giving intentionally right answers when she was doing white six's cards. And of course, her scene at the end where she's, you know, meets him and basically says, I know it's you, and I'm sorry, and says it kind of in that third person way, like, well, I would have told him I was sorry if I had the chance, but I didn't, so I'll tell you instead.
Well, I'm not sure about that, because first of all, I do agree with you that it could be read as being genuine ESP. So that's one possible interpretation of it. But that scene at the end where she does give that apology, I thought about that and I thought, is this a kind of one of those rare examples of someone, some other person in the village being genuine? Because almost every interaction that we've seen where someone has had a relationship with the prisoner, they have turned out to be an act in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And she has obviously put on an act previously, but this could be genuine. This moment could be genuine. On the other hand, if it weren't, it would be exactly the sort of thing that number two would want her to do, because it's inviting number six to reveal himself as the real number six at exactly the moment where number two is trying to figure it out. Now, the device he uses, the whole Susan thing, is obviously a much simpler way of doing it. Mm-hmm. But had he at that point acknowledged to her that he was the real number six, and she had been making out that she knew he was the real number six at number two's behest, and would then report it back to him, that would do the job. So, so we don't actually know which of those interpretations are correct. We know that number two didn't actually need her to do that in the end, but we don't know that he didn't put her up to it.
A couple of things also from the cutscenes from the script. In a cutscene, and I'd have to go back and watch it to see if what the footnotes say is correct. But in the cutscene, when Black and White goes to see her at the end, she is reading a book. The act of mind reading, or it's a title of the book, tells you that it's the magic act of mind reading, not the ESP mind reading. So she is actually reading a book that teaches you how to fake mind reading. And there's also a little cutscene where somebody says to her something to the effect of good memorizing, like she had memorized the order that the cards were in, something of that nature. So both of those got cut out. But according to the footnotes, the book is still sitting on the table in her house when he goes to see her. So it's not completely excised from the script, but it is there.
The existence of the scene suggests that my interpretation that it is an act would have been intended, but on the other hand, the fact they're edited out suggests that your interpretation that it's genuine ESP is what's intended. So.
But even when you read it, even when you read the script, the way it's written, then it's more obvious that the cigarette lighter thing was real ESP, because when he swips around that, you know, the notes to the acting say, you know, he realizes he's made a mistake. He's realized that this is one of those things she's talking about that's the real ESP. And then he fumbles and goes, well, I have to stop playing with these things. So it very explicitly says that he realizes that was a real ESP moment. So it's like both. It's like she's real ESP, but she's learning to fake ESP at the same time. It's
very appropriate.
And this is not a cut scene, but there's a note here about the first draft of the script. In the original draft, she has a different way of telling them who is the real number six. It's by kissing him. And guess who didn't want that in the script? Patrick McGoohan.
Well, obviously, that would be immoral.
That would be completely the wrong way to go about it. And so then they invented this sort of ESP card thing to fill in the gap for the kissing that wasn't going to happen. And one other thing, at the beginning of the episode, when he is with her, do you have any feel for that, the interaction between them? Because I kind of feel like he's playing with her. I kind of feel like we have that standard, I don't believe you, I think you're lying, smirk on his face the whole time.
Yes.
And it's not until he goes into number two's office and he suggests using her that I suddenly go, wait, he actually trusts her. And I don't get that in the opening scene. I get to feel like he's humoring her. It's like, all right, I don't know what your game is, but I'll go along with it. Practice your cards. You know, will we meet tomorrow? I don't know, maybe. He feels more regular prisoner attitude there than it did later. I was really, on first watching, I was surprised that he called her, because that implies trust. Although it's pretty obvious from the opening scene that somehow the psychic cards would have some way to play in the story. Although I must admit, I kind of thought that they would somehow play out to prove which one was the real number six, so I got double bluffed on that one. Which is what I like about this episode. I go back to that. I like that it's not a straightforward doppelganger story where we just introduce the doppelganger and we chaos or hilarity ensues, as the case may go, but that we add this ridiculous, I admit, extra layer of folding that back on itself and making the prisoner think he's the doppelganger and back, and he's trying to pull the fast one over himself. That is what I enjoy about it. Really, is that it isn't just the simplest of stories they could have come up with; that they've worked out a much more complicated and therefore prisoner-like. Because let's face it, the plans that they make for the prisoner are never simple. They are over elaborate and very complex, which I like.
Gives me something to
think about while I'm watching the show.
So I'm wondering, why did Rover kill Curtis? Because it seemed to me that number two had no intention of killing number six. In fact, exactly the opposite. So, and there would be no mileage in killing number 12, Curtis. So the way in which he was killed was that the real number six convinced him that he was the fake number six. And so Rover would have thought that it was killing the real number six. But why?
I don't know. And I think that's our first Rover kill, too. Usually Rover just disables.
Yeah, indeed. It's very unusual. And also, usually Rover isn't referred to as Rover, or I haven't heard Rover referred to as Rover.
I think we had discussed this earlier.
Because
well,
I was asked.
I had
you referred to it as Rover,
right.
and that puzzled me because it hadn't been referred to as Rover in the script. As far as I'm aware, this is the first time they've referred to Rover as Rover on screen.
It probably is. It probably is the first time that they referred to it. I don't know. I mean, in the original scripts, Rover was, in the very early scripts, Rover was actually like a moon buggy looking thing. And I've seen pictures of it, and
I'm glad they changed
that. It was horrific. I mean, it was terrible looking, and it was so ineffective on screen that they were desperate, and they came up with the idea of using a weather balloon, which is all Rover is a tethered weather balloon. Because it was cheap, they were able to get them, and they were in a tight spot.
And they look fantastic.
It does. It is makes a very different looking. And I noticed in this script that I think this is the first time Rover is referred to as a ball, basically. As opposed to in the earlier scripts, it had a siren on a light on top of it that was going round and round and mechanical legs and stuff. I mean, I'll try to find a picture or look online for a picture of the original Rover prop. It's horrific. It looks straight out of Doctor Who. It looks like one of the mechanical robots from the Pertwee era. It's not good. And wise choice. But why did he kill him? I really don't know. I don't know. And again, this is unfair because I think they did it right. I think it makes sense the way the story goes for Rover to have restrained him because real number six uses the keyword first.
Yes, no, it would make sense for Rover to put him out of action from a story point of view because number six is going to now impersonate number 12. He needs anyone who could blow that out of the way. And from a presumably, given McGowan's moral objections to his being seen to kiss anyone on screen, his being seen to actually bump this guy off would be problematic from that point of view. So I can see it's a story convenience, but there doesn't seem to be any attempt whatsoever to kind of justify it, really, in terms of the reason for it, the kind of in-story reason for it.
In the script, it plays out a little bit differently. White Six runs outside. There's Rover, and he shouts, "Schizoid man!" He gives the password, and the other six has come out as well. And so Rover moves towards our hero, and our hero goes, "Schizoid man!" And then Rover is confused. And
why would Rover be confused by that?
Because they both gave the password.
Surely Rover would assume that once the first one had shouted it out, the other one would know what it was.
Well, see, and that's why I think it plays out better on screen. So now what happens is that White Six panics because Rover's hesitating and he runs. And that's what triggers Rover off. He's like, that's the fake. He's trying to escape. So it almost sounds like it's truly is a malfunction in Rover. Because, and you hear that, it's like, you know, shut down Rover, find out what the malfunction was. It does kind of sound like it was intended to be Rover's logic circuits just got confused, and he's making a bolt for it, so get him. But it's unusually convenient that they would kill him, for the story. Because if they don't kill him, all they had to do is to check the fingerprints, because we know that the fingerprints actually would show who the real number six is. Which they didn't think to do there at the end. That would have been a good plot point for them.
Yes. I hadn't thought of that. Though I did think while the fingerprints were up there, and number six said, "Oh yes, that's my fingerprint." I did think, how many of us would recognize our fingerprint then?
Only our number six, who is, let's face it, an extraordinary individual. Not only does he know his own
pretty extraordinary.
He's on the Olympic fencing team and the Olympic boxing team.
But do we know that? I did wonder whether, because obviously we don't know these things in advance. And White Number 6 says he's an Olympic boxer. Do we get any confirmation from Real Number 6, who does get floored quite quickly,
actually,
that he can box, or does he maybe assume that because there's something wrong with his memory that he can't remember that?
I don't,
because earlier he's been psyched into using his right hand.
I don't think so.
To shoot.
I don't think so. I think that White 6, up to the point where we see him with the gun, I think White 6 is making a perfect Black 6 imitation. That he is as perfect as it possibly be. So I think when he says, that won't earn you a spot on the Olympic, what wouldn't earn you my spot on the Olympic fencing team, he really means that Number 6 had a spot on the Olympic. I think he did. And and that fits with the character of this extraordinary guy anyway.
Yes.
So I'll take that as red. Now, I was a little less sure when Black 6 said, I suppose you were on the Olympic boxing team as well. And White 6, well, you've read my file. That one I was a little less sure.
Yeah,
that's
the one I wasn't sure about.
So,
because this is the thing, because we don't know. We know so little, in fact, about Number 6. That we couldn't know the answer to that. Number 6 wouldn't. There's obviously the unreliability of his memory. He wouldn't know that. As in our real Number 6, Black Number 6. White Number 6 is obviously a fake, so he could be lying. So there is no kind of bedrock here. We have no. There is nothing to hang the truth on. We don't know how to evaluate whether this is correct or not.
I'm thinking that the first time he makes a mistake would be fatal to the accuracy of the plan, though. I mean, this plan relies on him being perfect, so I can't picture him intentionally or even unintentionally making something up like that. But
so you trust the fake number 6?
I actually trust the fake number 6 up to the point where he was holding the gun, that everything he said about Number 6 was exactly accurate, because it had to be.
Okay, that makes sense.
It just like the little, the details have to be exactly right when Black 6 is looking at the statue and he says, this should be gilt, not silver. And Number 2 says, now this guy, you got to get this exactly right. And I think he is. So one couple things. One was, first time we see the recreation hall, in the story, that works out okay. And in our vein of talking about things that were science fiction when this show was made, but we wouldn't look at it like cordless phones. You wouldn't look at the show and think anything about it. The electronic guns, the electronic shooting range.
Ah.
I think that's totally sci-fi in when this show was made. And now, don't even bat an eye and think, oh yeah, they could have an electronic shooting range. I've got one on my TV at home, on the Wii.
Yes. Yeah.
So, also, there was a cut scene after that, but after the fencing, but before the boxing, where they went motor car rallying through the village. They actually got in like Formula One cars and drove around the village. Probably cut because of budget, and that this was not shot in Port Marion. Almost said Port.
Was
I almost said Port Wynn. Obviously, Doc Martin's back on the air. No, it wasn't. This was shot in the studio.
Yes, I suppose. I hadn't really registered how little the kind of normal locations were used. Obviously, there's a shot from the helicopter, but that could be reused footage, presumably.
Right. Apparently, it was shot in November, so it was not a good time to be shooting outside anyway in Wales. So they just had to use a studio at that time. So, but it doesn't show in this one. I think they did a much better job of hiding it than they did in Chimes of Big Ben, where there's some pretty dodgy back projection stuff going on. I don't think I've got anything else on this episode. But again, we do kind of come to that idea that I've mentioned before, and I'm sure that when I've mentioned it before, my vision is colored by having seen the entire series. So, once you have this in your mind, you can see it everywhere. But again, this is the prisoner. You have to be true to yourself. He has that sense of identity, and here they're trying to shake that. So that's his strong sense of identity and self has really kind of been brought as a weapon against him in this one. And I think that's a good plan. This plan didn't work, obviously.
Good, as exceedingly elaborate and far-fetched plan.
Elaborate, and it didn't involve sharks with lasers, but it was a good plan in terms of what they were trying to attack. Instead of trying to get him to, you know, follow along with elections and free democracy and silly nonsense like that,
yes,
and do conformity into the mass, here they are attacking his identity. And that, I think that's what holds on. I mean, that is what he holds on to. His identity as himself. I am a free man. I'm not a number. That whole things that they want him to not be the individual he is, and you know, that's the whole battle. And in this one, they take it right to the front lines. They go straight for his sense of identity, whereas they're kind of fighting around the peripheries on the other episodes. So one of the reasons I really like this is one of my top episodes of The Prisoner. Not my top episode. My top episode will probably surprise the heck out of you when we get to it, because it won't be anyone else's. But anyway. Have you got anything else?
No. Right. That's covered all of my notes.
Okay, well, offhand, I don't know what the next episode of The Prisoner is.
I believe it is The General.
Ah, yes, The General. And interesting, they mentioned The General at the end of this episode. I wonder if it's the same General.
Ah, well, that didn't occur to me, but then I didn't know the next episode was going to be called The General, so.
Oh, well. Then when we come back for our next episode of Prisoner, we will be talking about The General. Simon, thank you for joining me.
It's been a pleasure, as always.
And we hope our listeners will all join us again next time on Fusion Patrol.
Fusion Patrol is a Lone Locust production. Like us, leave us a review on iTunes. Or stop by and visit at our website, fusionpatrol.com. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, search for Fusion Patrol, or just drop us a note at feedback@fusionpatrol.com. Our music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolf.